Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to another day in the TeleSummit. It's about how you live, taking the fear out of having conversations about advanced care planning, serious illness, palliative care, end-of-life care. So today is a really special day. We are honored to have Dr. Anthony Galanos, who is the Medical Director of Palliative Care Services at Duke University. So welcome, Dr. Galanos.
Hi there.
So honored to have you here. So honored to have you here. So
pleasure.
Before we kind of get into it, I would like to take a second to read your bio so everybody knows a little bit more about you, and then we'll get into it. So Dr. Galanos is, like I said, the Medical Director of Palliative Care Services at Duke University. He started out in geriatrics and over time moved into palliative care. His original research was on the functional status of community-dwelling elderly. With time, he focused his research on the hospital setting, specifically with regard to end-of-life care. His hope is to make the hospital a more user-friendly setting for folks with life-limiting illness. So, again, we are so honored. You are such a talented physician at such a prestigious university as Duke University. So, again, thank you so much. And what I would like to start with is there's a great video of you on the Duke University website. And you talk a little bit about how people, they call you Dr. G, and you have a little bit of a unique approach. So can we just kind of start there?
Yeah. Thanks for having me. First and foremost, please call me Tony.
Okay.
And the patients and the house staff and actually the whole hospital kind of calls me Dr. G. That's been going on for over 20 years now, where saying Galanos was hard. And I rap when I lecture, and the house staff started calling me G Money, and that got shortened to G.
So, that's funny.
I'm Dr. G to a lot of people, and I like that because it's much more warm and more of a connection, and allows for good conversation in a short amount of time, which in the hospital, all of us are pressured to do that.
Right.
And I'm happy to say I've become fairly successful at that. And the G part also makes it so easy for the patient to remember me compared to all the other multitude of white coats that walk in the room.
Good point.
So it's really... Oh, it's good and bad. They don't forget you. So I go by Dr. G, and it works very well.
Good. All right. So I have got a few questions that I'd love to kind of address. There's lots of things to talk about, and we've got 30 minutes. So let me kind of get right into it. Let's start with your definition of palliative care, as some of our viewers are likely a little confused about what palliative care is.
Yeah. Well, not just patients and laypersons, but medical professionals as well.
Absolutely.
What a difficult term, right? So I have several definitions ready. For when I'm talking with another doctor, I say that it's a medical specialty, board certification, emphasis on symptom management, and goals of care discussions. When I talk to patients and families, palliative care, the first thing I say out of my mouth is, it's not hospice. We work with hospice, we like hospice, but we're not hospice.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the hospital setting, that can scare somebody. The word palliative care can scare them, and certainly the word hospice can as well. Another definition is for learners like residents and medical students, doctor, what do you do for your patients you can't cure? So if cure is your only outcome, you're going to be sorely disappointed and you're going to not serve the patient well. So it gets them thinking outside their normal box. Another definition I use for patients and family is palliative care is an extra layer of support to help you navigate the system so that your needs are met regardless of your prognosis.
Wonderful.
Keep it short. That I think the less docs talk, the better. And I think I have a different definition depending on what is the need of the person who's asking the question?
Right. And you made a great point. A lot of people may not realize that it is a specialty, just like cardiology is for heart.
Right.
Or oncology is for cancer. A lot of people don't realize that.
Right. Right. I think in my shop they do, but it's always helpful because, you know, you want a seat at the table and you want to influence the culture. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to do that by being passive, shy, or too modest. Mm-hmm. So I've learned to be much more assertive, kind of like Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In. Mm-hmm. Much more assertive, and I'm not modest. Yeah. That doesn't work at a place like Duke.
Right, absolutely. And then you also used a term that some people may not know what that means. So goals of care. Can you give a definition to people that might not know what that means?
Yeah, I just read a study while I was waiting for your phone call. We're doing a study on surgical patients that we've done consultation. And over 65% of the patients we've seen on surgical services was for goals of care, which is a nice way of saying we want to ask them what they want to accomplish and how they want to get there. And if their prognosis is poor and we can't have plan A, what is plan B? So goals of care is a very broad term, as you adroitly point out, that really means, oh, we might not get what we want. We need to sit down and chat a little bit. And if time is short, for example, where do we want to spend it?
Right.
Who do you want to spend it with? And where? That would be a goals of care discussion versus we're doing a consult for intractable nausea and vomiting.
Yeah. So two, I guess, primary reasons people would call you in is goals of care, which you just described, or symptom management.
Yes. We love symptom management. In the early days, we were associated with end-of-life care only. And that really hurt the growth of the field, because docs were not going to invite other docs to come see their patients if the only association was end of life.
Right.
So we've overcome a lot since, well, I've been doing this since 1998.
Wow.
And the culture was not, the ground was not fertile for this kind of activity. And now we've grown quite a bit, and we're inpatient and outpatient. And I do want to say that palliative care is not just in hospitals anymore. It's very much grown and is growing faster in the outpatient arena than it is on the inpatient.
And I think, generally speaking, would you agree that more and more people are trying to encourage the physicians to incorporate palliative care at the beginning of a serious diagnosis?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So at the time of diagnosis, regardless of prognosis, and, you know, that's why we just call it an extra layer.
Right.
Sometimes where we are front and center, and other times when we're peripheral. And I just had an idea for another study this weekend. People that we saw on a previous admission, that now we're seeing them, and their goals of care have changed, and what we're doing has more impact this admission than it did two admissions ago.
Interesting. Yeah. That would be great. That would be great. All right. Wonderful. All right. Let me move on to, there are a few topics in palliative care that are currently of particular interest. And so we're going to kind of talk and you may have touched a little bit on this one. The first one I was going to ask you about was that outpatient palliative care.
Yeah. Yeah. So as what we learned is that as we were growing and growing, you know, 150 consults this year, 400 that year, 600, now we're over 1,200. What do we do for the folks once they leave? And the good news is, again, getting away from end-of-life care, over half of our people go home that we saw in consultation. About another quarter go to hospice, either home hospice or inpatient hospice. And about another quarter really are very near the end of life when we're called.
Oh, wow.
That can be because the consults are being called very late.
Mm-hmm.
And hospice suffers from the same problem. If you look at national hospice data, patients are rarely getting to use the full 6 months of their Medicare benefit, usually much less. So, and we've been working on that as well. So now in this new age, we have developed, and I think most places have done this, certainly at our shop, a robust outpatient system, so that when you do need an oncology service, when you go back to see the oncologist the same day you see the palliative care doc or nurse practitioner, and we are housed in the Cancer Institute, so it's very convenient for our patients. And this last 2 or 3 years, we've branched out into COPD, congestive heart failure, progressive neurologic diseases like ALS. So the outpatient arena is going to really expand because folks need a place to go besides the emergency room for their symptoms that come from either their disease and or their treatment.
Absolutely.
And our outpatient slots are filling up rather quickly, rather nicely. The other thing it does, it allows bridges to be built, so many different programs. So, for example, Brain Tumor Center and our palliative care service have recently become good buddies. I just did neurosurgery grand rounds 2 weeks ago, and in that I could talk to these docs about our outpatient clinic, which is much more helpful to them sometimes than even our inpatient consults.
Right.
Our relationship with the congestive heart failure service, we're married now, because the patients we see inpatient, we follow them outpatient with the cardiologist, and this has really helped the patients, particularly those with advanced therapies like left ventricular assist devices, or they're going home on inotropic meds that can only be given IV only, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So I think it just makes sense.
Wonderful.
Our clinical, I'm the director of our clinical programs, and I'm happy to tell you we're just building bridge after bridge after bridge to make, like the title of your series, to make discussions just part of the fabric, as opposed to, we got to have the discussion.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. And our viewers are medical professionals as well as just general people in the community. So
Yeah. Whatever
that was you just said,
yeah.
I'm sure our medical professionals probably understood what that was. It kind of woo did this on me. But bottom line is, what a wonderful thing that this outpatient setting is becoming more, that's just the best level of care you can offer. I mean, it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
On so many levels.
Right. We shouldn't just put a Band-Aid on everything. And sadly, in the inpatient arena, which I know the best, our lengths of stay are getting shorter and shorter. And so the opportunity to have discussion is there, but the follow-up is what's necessary.
Right.
And when take congestive heart failure, you know, you don't know which admission is the final admission.
Right.
And there could be 5 more or 7 more admissions. Wouldn't it be great to have the conversation ongoing in the outpatient arena while you're addressing their shortness of breath and the fluid buildup, and you're seeing them the same day as the cardiologist? It just makes sense that if we coordinate our care, the patient and family tend to benefit.
Absolutely. My mother had COPD, and she had palliative care for 2 years before she was appropriate for hospice.
There you go.
It was a godsend. I mean, it really was. It was.
When the model works, it's compelling.
Yes. So we talked about outpatient palliative care. What about, and this is obviously, well, it's all kind of heart-wrenching, but pediatric palliative.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Speak about that.
Oh, happy to. So I think there's 2 movements that are really strong. Besides outpatient, the next step in that direction would be population palliative care. So we'll get to that one.
Okay.
But if you want to back it up, so here's my vision for what we're going to do at Duke. From cradle to grave and beyond, because bereavement is so important. Well, we are really blessed here. Dr. Bittegain has been doing neonatal palliative care for 20 years. In other words, meeting with parents of children that we knew before they were born that there was going to be a serious, serious issue, and helping them navigate those waters, particularly if the baby was going to be born with something that would cause great suffering.
Right.
So that part has been around for a long time at our shop. What we've recently done by recruiting people who have a background in both internal medicine and pediatrics, it's a separate specialty called MedPeds. These folks are phenomenal at pediatric palliative care. And our numbers there have grown exponentially. And we just added two new faculty this summer and in the PEDS program. And my fantasy for them is that next summer or the summer after, we'll have a pediatric palliative care outpatient clinic.
Wow.
And at Duke and other places that are big like UNC and Winston-Salem, why not have a pediatric palliative care fellowship?
Right.
There's only four or five in the country, so we're woefully behind. But right. that's going to happen before I retire.
Oh,
we're
going to
have a fellowship for PEDS and palliative care so that these children who have terrible scenarios that they have to live with, extremely long lengths of stay that make much, much longer than the adult side, we need to do a better job of communicating with their parents and giving them an option other than just stopping.
Right. Wow. Wow, that's exciting. That's really exciting. Let me see. So we touched on pediatric. You may have touched on this a little bit, but if we can just expand on it a little bit. In my work with hospice, often people think that hospice and palliative care is one and the same.
Yeah.
I know you mentioned at the very beginning, you know, that can get confusing. So can you describe for our viewers the relationship between hospice and palliative care, what they have in common, and how they differ in the patient's plan of care?
I think the best way to describe it is that hospice and palliative care work well together, are siblings, but are not the same persons.
Right.
Very distinct. And hospice, by definition, is end-of-life care. It's a well-defined Medicare benefit where a person has 6 months or less to live, and that has to be attested to by a couple of physicians. And hopefully that's wrong and the patient lives longer and can re-enroll in hospice ad nauseum, and that's wonderful.
Yeah.
But that's hospice. So by definition, hospice is expert palliative care at the end of life. Palliative care can be at any point in the trajectory of the illness, including at the time of diagnosis. Have a personal example of that. When my sister was diagnosed with breast cancer, her main concern was not herself, but her two children. Palliative care would have been ideal. She's was at home in Alabama, where we're from, where there was no palliative care. And she basically got routine oncologic care without that extra layer of support till she came to Duke. And then she got the full court, got the full menu, if you will. And her concerns about her children and bereavement care and how everyone was coping with uncertainty was addressed and addressed well. And it was a good example of pain and symptom management as well as attention to the psychosocial needs of the patient and the family. So I find that palliative care is much further upstream. There's no time where it's not welcome or can't be useful. Whereas hospice, by definition, being a Medicare benefit, has many rules around it, and one of which is 6 months or less to live.
That's right. And that was beautiful. And and I'm so sorry about your sister. Another wonderful thing is that when people are seeking curative treatment, maybe the treatment itself causes symptoms.
Sure.
And so your practice is to help manage whatever issues the treatments are causing.
Absolutely. We're very comfortable with both aggressive care, like our brain tumor patients who are getting surgery, radiation, and or chemo, as well as folks whose story might end here in the hospital and need good end-of-life care, and there is no hospice in the hospital. Mm-hmm. So I kind of feel like a hospice doctor sometimes, but I would prefer if we can get our patients to the appropriate hospice setting. We work together, but we're quite separate.
Right. And
for folks who are just absolutely petrified of the term, what we call the H word, I just tell them I'm pain and symptom management. And my job is I can't cure their whatever, but I can make them feel better. And if I can't do that, they can fire me within 48 hours. And so far, I haven't been fired.
And I do believe that when palliative care is incorporated into a hospice patient's, I mean, you know, that's what they do. That's one of the reasons people live longer once they're in hospice care, as opposed to those that aren't in hospice care but would be eligible, is the fact that you can make them feel better.
Yes.
You know, if you're laying there hurting, who wants to do that for a long, long time? But if you can make me feel better, and that's, I think, one of the reasons why people will graduate from hospice, like you said, and because the palliative piece of it, you know, it's all about managing those, that pain and those symptoms.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. Who doesn't want that? Lord E. So you had mentioned that you've added two new pediatric, are they physicians or NPs, or tell me again for the,
The last summer we added a pediatric NP who's wonderful in palliative, pediatric palliative care. This summer, we added a fellow who's a pediatrician who's learning adult palliative care, and a faculty member who does pediatric palliative care.
And for a viewer out there that might not know what NP is, that's nurse practitioner.
Right.
So because the department is growing, where do you see palliative care going in the future, especially given I'm a boomer, I think you're a boomer, and there are a lot of us, and we're called now the silver tsunami. So with that aging population, where do you hope the future will take us with palliative care?
I think we're going to see palliative care out in the community, in population health. Mm-hmm. I think healthcare systems have looked at who they serve, and obviously the frail elders are a subset of a population that utilizes a number of resources and still has bad outcomes. So how do we get to these folks before they have to be in the hospital, which is a terrible place for a frail elder? How do we help their families? How do we do preventive medicine? How do we have advanced care planning? That's just part of care. So we are very tight with Duke Geriatrics. I'm a Duke geriatrician. The geriatric fellows now rotate on palliative care.
Oh, great.
They take our communication modules along with our fellows in palliative care. It's a program called Vital Talk. And there's even a subspecialty thing called Geri Talk, G-E-R-I. So I think you're going to see docs as they train learning much, much, much more about communication than in the past. And these could be people out in primary care in the community and or our geriatrician colleagues in the clinic. I think that's where we're going, where the preventive palliative care is going to be the star next 5 years. What I'm doing in the hospital, I want to keep doing because the need is obvious. But if we can help people before they even get here, wouldn't that be wonderful?
And your term population health, can you explain to some folks that might not know what that is?
Yeah, so I think every hospital system is looking at, so who do they serve? Where do they come from? What are the demographics? Who comes to the hospital 6 times a year versus 12 times a year versus more? And is there a way to reach these people in their homes before they ever need to come to an emergency room?
Right.
For myself, when I talk to patients, my mom taught me this, and she only went to the sixth grade. You don't be arrogant. You're not going to cure very many people, but you can make every single person feel better. Mm-hmm. And Inez Galanos was right. And so that's where I work in that domain. But I also know that, wow, we could do so much better than letting them get. The other domain is, I don't want anybody to sit in an emergency room for 8 to 12 hours. So that means population palliative care. That means getting a nurse practitioner or a PA or a doc in the house before they're, not hospice, but before they end up coming in for 6 admissions for heart failure.
Right. Exactly.
Why can't we weigh them in their house? Why can't we do Lasix before they end up in the emergency room? Actually, we can.
That's right.
And those models are being tested now.
And I know the EMS organization, Emergency Medical Services throughout the country, has a program. Some people are calling it mobile integrated health. Some people are calling it community paramedicine. But the idea is exactly the example you gave. This person that is a frequent flyer to the emergency department because of some symptom. Those folks, that it's maybe just an education thing. So instead of a $1,000 truck ride in the ambulance to the ED, the EMS folks will make appointments to go see that person. Are you taking your Lasix? Do you understand when you're supposed to take your Lasix or whatever the issue is?
Yes.
And
yes,
just help educate them to try to cut down on those expensive truck rides to the ED. And I think what they're trying to do, and the palliative care and population health, I mean, all those things are just really trying to cut down on what could have, an ED visit that could have been avoided otherwise.
Yeah. Good old preventive medicine with a with a twist of palliative lime.
Absolutely. That's good. That's a good cocktail. That's a very good cocktail. So we are about ready to wrap up. Are there any, again, we've got medical professionals on listening and watching. We've got just general people in the community. If you had them sitting in front of you right now, or you were in their home talking to them, like what words of wisdom, what a change, maybe a shift in their mindset would you like them to have as far as dealing with, maybe some of them have a serious illness going on in their family right now. Maybe some of them have, somebody that's nearing a hospice situation with a 6 month or less prognosis. I mean, what would you like these people to know and understand and try to move forward in their life in a different way?
I would tell them to get in front of medical students. It's too late when they're already doctors. Get in front of medical students, so that they're not afraid of that which they don't understand. So if you don't understand the term palliative care, try to learn about it rather than rebuff it. That's one. Two is, if you've never had a communication course in med school or residency, go get one, because the one lesion, our Achilles, is our inability to communicate well. Mm. And I've had so many goals of care and end of life discussion. I'm sure I'm in 4,000 or 5,000 by now. It can become part of who you are. It can be genuine. It can be natural. It does not have to be scripted or stilted or because you failed. I would tell them, you might think you're a good communicator. I'm going to bet you're not. I'm going to make that challenge. So if you don't understand palliative care, go learn about it. And if you think you're a wonderful communicator, I challenge you to prove it.
Right.
And there are ways, there are teaching modules where they videotape you and then show you the tape. And you can see for yourself whether you actually are a good communicator or not. Because that's what we're going to need as we go forward, is not more machines, but more ability to talk to people and help them navigate the waters. Because maybe they don't want an LVAD. Or if they do, they need to understand the consequences of that 3 or 5 years down the road. And that takes communication skills.
That's right. That's right. Wow. Well, this was a huge treat, not only for me, but for everybody that's listening in. I want to make sure, is there like a website or something that you could offer these people if they want to know more about you and your work and Duke and the outpatient clinic and all that kind of thing?
Well, the Duke Palliative Care website is there, and I think all of us are listed. There's about 20 of us now on the faculty doing everything from research to, most of us do straight clinical work, and then we're all invested in education with the PA school, the NP school, and second and fourth year med students, health staff, critical care fellows. Like I said, we're just building bridge after bridge after bridge. Right. So our website is there. I'm not any different than anybody in our group, except I'm older. I'm a little bit more outspoken because I started it, and I, like I said at the beginning, modesty does not help. You know, if I had one wish for our chaplain colleagues, stop being so quiet and speak up, because you can do more good that way than just being melting into the background. Right. Palliative care is no longer in the background, Tina. We are sitting at the table, and we're changing the paradigm, and none too soon. So yeah. Let's just all keep it going.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, again, thank you, Dr. Anthony, or Tony Galanos. This has been a huge treat, and I cannot thank you enough for taking the time and educating all of us. So, like you said, if you don't know what palliative care is, go look it up, learn about it, and if you're a medical professional and you might want to check into some communication classes or call Dr. Tony and Dr. G and see if he'll give you some one-on-one instructions. So anyway, thank you again so very much. This was lovely.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for all the wonderful work you do every day, every single day with your patients and their families.
You got it.